political independent wary of formal party affiliations. He must take on the Clinton political machine that has retooled after its defeat in 2008. He is a minnow in the money game in a campaign that will be awash in billions of dollars. He's not exactly a polished poll either, with an unrepentant message of class warfare that makes him an unlikely candidate to win over middle America. And many Democrats are only beginning to learn who Sanders actually is. He's a long shot, but has shown some momentum since indicating he would take the plunge into the presidential race late last month. In a new Quinnipiac University poll released on Thursday, Sanders was at 15% of Democratic voters nationwide, up from the 5% he managed in a CNN national poll last month. Further, by the time I announced my intention to run for president in late April, Hillary Clinton had already, through an incredibly unfair system supported by the Democratic establishment, received the support of some 400 superdelegates, about 15% of what she needed in order to win the nomination. She had also received tens of millions of dollars from leading financial backers. In addition, she had lined up almost every Democratic governor, mayor, senator, and congressperson who intended to make an endorsement. Because of the Clintons' long-standing contacts inside the Beltway, she had also won the support of the leadership of most of the unions, environmental groups, and women's and LGBT groups. Her lock on establishment support was so strong that by the end of the campaign, I ended up winning the endorsement of one major newspaper. She won the support of dozens. That's what we were running against. In the face of this, our campaign strategy was not complicated. If the campaign was to succeed and gain momentum, we absolutely had to do well in the early states, Iowa and New Hampshire, followed by strong showings in Nevada and South Carolina. If we did poorly in the early states, the media would lose interest, our funding would dry up, and the campaign would be dead in its tracks. In the early stages of the campaign, we did not have the luxury of planning out a national 50-state strategy. It was all or nothing in the early states, especially Iowa and New Hampshire. As we thought about New Hampshire, the first stop for us on the campaign trail and the second state up in the nominating process, there was good news and bad news. The good news was that I was reasonably well known in the state given its proximity to Vermont. The bad news was that Clinton was popular in New Hampshire and way ahead of us in early polls. In 2008, she had defeated Obama there, resurrecting her campaign after a loss in Iowa. Bill Clinton had also done well in New Hampshire when he was a candidate. In fact, in his 1992 campaign, amidst all of the allegations regarding sexual impropriety that were then plaguing him, he did well enough there to become the comeback kid. Our plan for New Hampshire was pretty simple. In the last contested Democratic primary there in 2008, when Clinton defeated Obama, 287,000 people voted. My thought was that if we worked really hard, we could hold 100 town meetings and rallies in the state leading up to the primary in early February. We could accomplish that by spending 30 or 40 days campaigning there, doing two or three events a day. If we were able to bring out an average of 100 people a meeting, which I thought possible, we would be able to bring some 10,000 people to our meetings. And that's pretty good. In 2008, Clinton won New Hampshire with 112,404 votes. If the voter turnout was similar in 2016, it would mean that almost 10% of the people I needed to win would have heard from me face to face. And those who attended have husbands and wives, brothers and sisters and friends whom they talk to. Word of mouth, after all, is the best form of advertising. If we were able to accomplish that goal, I believe that we could do well there. I spent the night of the kickoff, May 26, 2015, at home in Burlington. And then we hit the road early the following morning. We were off to New Hampshire to be followed with trips to Iowa and Minnesota. The first stop was a town meeting at the New England College in Concord, New Hampshire. And we got lost. The GPS got us to exactly the right address on Main Street, but it was the wrong town. Not a great way to begin the campaign. 15 minutes late, we found a parking spot and made our way into the building. The turnout was large, about 200 people, larger than the room could accommodate. It was standing room only. The format for the event was similar to that of many meetings I had held in Vermont. A number of young people on a panel got up and talked about what was going on in their lives. They discussed the student debt that they were incurring, their hopes and fears about job opportunities, and their views on social issues. After the panel finished, I spoke and then took some questions. After the meeting ended, I was told that there was a crowd of people outside the building who couldn't get in. My staff found a location about a block away where I talked to them using a megaphone. This pattern of rooms large and small not being able to accommodate the crowds that we were attracting repeated itself over and over again during the campaign. It was a problem, but a very good problem. In the evening, after a house party in Epping, we continued on to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, one of the larger towns in the state. And here was the first real surprise of the campaign. On a hot spring night in the beautiful and historic South Church in downtown Portsmouth, 700 enthusiastic supporters came out to the rally. This was an extraordinary crowd for a small state like New Hampshire this early in the campaign. Tad Devine, who had worked on a number of national campaigns and had observed Obama's 2008 campaign carefully, said that he had never seen anything like it. Other than the fact that the room was extremely hot and my shirt was soaked with sweat, the event went very well. Needless to say, as happened throughout the campaign, excerpts from the speech got around the country to many thousands of people through social media. No question about it. Our first day on the campaign trail was a great success. I was feeling good. As we drove back to the hotel in Portsmouth, I did a quick calculation. My hope had been to speak to 10,000 voters in New Hampshire with 30 to 40 days of campaigning. Well, on our very first day, in the three meetings that we held, we had already spoken to 1,000 people. Maybe the goal of 10,000 was too conservative. Maybe over the course of the campaign, we would be speaking to a lot more people. Maybe we could actually win New Hampshire. Not only were we off to a great start on the campaign trail, our online fundraising was also doing very well. My staff and I were shocked, and the national media was surprised as well, when in the first 24 hours of my candidacy, we raised $1.5 million in small contributions from 35,000 donors. After 4 days, $3 million had come in from 75,000 donors. That's serious money. The media may not pay much attention to the ideas that a candidate espouses, but they do pay attention to your fundraising capabilities. And no matter how you slice it, 75,000 donors in 4 days was pretty impressive. As the media noted early on, I was raising more money than most of the Republican establishment candidates, and we were doing it with large numbers of small contributions. After our day in New Hampshire, we were on an early morning plane from Boston to Iowa. We had scheduled 5 events there over a 3-day period. The first event at St. Ambrose University in Davenport was extraordinary. There were 700 people in attendance, the largest turnout for any candidate yet during the 2016 campaign season in Iowa. Many of those who attended were students, but many were from the community. It was a great cross-section of Iowans. As I often did, I took questions from the audience. When the question and answer period was over, I stayed around and chatted with a number of people who came to the front of the auditorium. One of those people was a recent dental school graduate. During my speech, I had remarked about how I met a physician in Vermont who graduated from medical school $300,000 in debt. This young woman gave me a new statistic to shock people with. She was $400,000 in debt. At a time when we have a desperate need for more dentists, how crazy is it to put young people in such a horrendous financial position? 2 days later, we had another great Iowa rally, this time in Iowa City. We had more than 1,100 people show up, and the enthusiasm was sky high. The most interesting and promising event of that campaign swing, however, was in a town called Kensett, Iowa, where 300 people packed the community center. What was surprising about the turnout there was that, according to the last census, there were only 266 people in the entire town. In other words, in one of the most rural parts of a rural state, there was significant interest in the need for a political revolution. This was not an audience of political activists, of young people, of trade unionists, of academics. This was an audience of working people and farmers who were sick and tired of the political status quo, and they wanted real change in our country. How did I end up in Kensett? As the Albert Lee Tribune reported, Kurt Myers, chairman of the Tri-County Democrats, which covers Worth, Mitchell, and Howard counties in northern Iowa, called Sanders an effective, articulate, passionate fighter for social justice. He said Sanders came to Kensett at the invitation of Democratic activist Jim Burge of Kensett. Sanders reportedly read a favorable comment in a Washington, D.C. newspaper that quoted Burge. The next day, one of the senator's staff members called Burge to thank him for his remarks, and Burge ultimately invited him to visit the next time he was in Iowa. I love the comment that Mr. Myers made on the Rachel Maddow Show in response to Rachel's question as to why so many people showed up. He said, "I think there are naturally people that are going to come to Kensett because Kensett has waited a long time between presidents or presidential candidates coming. There's a story that FDR perhaps came through on the whistle stop in 1936, but only came through town, didn't stop, and talk in town. So, you know, that's a long way to wait. And so you can imagine some people would come just because a presidential candidate is a rare occurrence in Kensett." That, by the way, is what an insurgent campaign is all about. Campaigning in a town that no presidential candidate had ever visited. While some people may have come to the meeting out of curiosity, the response that I got told me that most didn't. In fact, that meeting confirmed to me what I had long believed. Rural people are not as conservative as the Democratic leadership has long believed, and their vote should not be conceded to right-wing Republicans. Kensett was the first, but not the last, large turnout that we had in very rural communities throughout the country. The turnouts in New Hampshire and Iowa were extraordinary, much larger than we had anticipated. But the first indication that this campaign was taking off much faster than any of us had believed possible took place on June 1st, 2015 in Minneapolis, Minnesota. As we were driving to our destination, the Minneapolis American Indian Center, we went past a very long line of people who appeared to be snaked out for blocks. I wondered out loud what was going on and if there was some kind of concert taking place. When we had reached the Minneapolis American Indian Center, I truly was stunned to learn that the crowd was there for us. The maximum number of people we could get into the hall was about 2,000. There were about 3,000 outside who couldn't get in. This was far and away the largest turnout for our campaign up to that point. In the airport in Minneapolis, on the way back to Washington, I bumped into the two senators from Minnesota, Amy Klobuchar and Al Franken. We had coffee together while we waited for the plane. They were pretty surprised to learn that 5,000 people had just come out to our meeting. As the Star Tribune wrote about the event, the crowd, with some people standing outside because the hall was full, seemed unconcerned with the conventional wisdom that there is no race on the Democratic side as Hillary Clinton marches toward the nomination with a pile of money, endorsements, and party faithfuls' love of the Clinton name. From day one of the campaign, we realized that the debates with Secretary Clinton would be enormously important. At a time when my name recognition was low, the debates would give me exposure to millions of voters and increase credibility as I contrasted my views with hers. We wanted as many debates as possible and as early as possible. In early June, I wrote a letter to the chair of the Democratic National Committee, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. I urged that as many debates as possible be held and that they begin in the summer. Straw polls don't mean anything. They are totally unscientific. They reflect the views only of the people who are at a given place at a given time. Nonetheless, we were surprised and delighted when a straw poll taken at the Wisconsin State Democratic Party Convention in early June showed us with 41% support, only 8 points behind Secretary Clinton at 49%. Unscientific though it may have been, this was the first poll of any kind showing us within reach of Clinton. John Nichols, a writer from The Nation, who is from Wisconsin, called the straw poll, quote, another sign of unexpected and significant support for Sanders. Nichols noted that the most important support that we were receiving was coming from organized labor. On June 6th, I returned to New Hampshire. Once again, the turnout was larger than we had anticipated. At Keene High School, there was a standing room only crowd of 1,100 people. In that speech, I made a point that I was going to make over and over again. I said that real change in this country could only take place if millions of people got involved in the political process. I stated, and this is what I said, this campaign is not about Bernie Sanders. You can have the best president in the history of the world, but that person will not be able to address the problems that we face unless there is a mass movement, a political revolution in this country. Right now, the only pieces of legislation that get to the floor of the House and Senate are sanctioned by big money, Wall Street, the pharmaceutical industry, etc. The only way we win and transform America is when millions of people stand up, as you are doing today, and say, enough is enough. This country belongs to all of us and not just a handful of billionaires. One of the dilemmas of being on the campaign trail, if you are a sitting member of the U.S. Senate, is that you can't be in two places at the same time. That means that there are votes you will miss in Washington because you are in some other part of the country. And it also means not being able to attend events in your own state. The best way that I could reconcile the latter concern was scheduling events in Vermont on the same days that I would be across the Connecticut River in New Hampshire. On the same day that I spoke in Keene, New Hampshire, I also marched in the Strolling of the Heifers event in Brattleboro, Vermont. This is one of the fun events in Vermont and the biggest parade in the state, organized by my old friend Orly Munzing. It draws some 10,000 people from all over New England, including my son Levy and his three kids from nearby Claremont, New Hampshire. The event focuses attention on dairy, the largest agricultural industry in Vermont. The parade includes cows marching up Brattleboro's Main Street and a whole lot of floats from local organizations, from the Girl Scouts to the local bank. It is also my one day of the year when I get to milk a cow. Not a pretty sight for real dairy farmers. As the campaign progressed, Hillary Clinton's political vulnerabilities were becoming more and more apparent. She had started several super PACs, which were collecting millions of dollars from Wall Street, not exactly the constituency of working Americans and progressive Democrats, and not what ordinary Americans wanted to see in a candidate. She had voted for the war in Iraq, the worst foreign policy blunder in the modern history of our country. She supported fracking and was a relative latecomer in supporting gay marriage. She had also supported, in one capacity or another, virtually every one of the disastrous trade agreements that had cost our country millions of decent-paying jobs and contributed to the race to the bottom. On June 14th, in an appearance on the CBS News program Face the Nation, I challenged Clinton on her trade position and urged her to join progressives in the Senate like Elizabeth Warren, Sherrod Brown, and myself in opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, known as the TPP. This was the largest trade agreement in the history of our country and incorporated many of the same elements that made previous trade agreements so destructive for the American working class. In previous comments, Secretary Clinton had referred to the TPP as the quote-unquote gold standard for what a trade agreement should be. During the program, I stated, I would hope very much that Secretary Clinton will side with every union in this country, virtually every environmental group, and many religious groups, and say that this TPP policy is a disaster, that it must be defeated, and that we need to regroup and come up with a trade policy that demands that corporate America starts investing in this country rather than in countries all over the world. In early October, I was pleased that Secretary Clinton came out in opposition to the TPP. While the minority population of Vermont is growing, it remains very much a white state. We have a small African-American population and an even smaller Latino one. One of the challenges I faced early on in the campaign was to familiarize myself with issues that I had not been heavily involved with as Vermont's representative in the House and Senate. When we began the campaign, we had virtually no support or name recognition in the Latino community, and we were running against a candidate who had the backing of virtually the entire Hispanic caucus in Congress and, over the years, relationships with many leaders of Latino organizations. One of my campaign's accomplishments that I am most proud of is that by the end of it, we were winning the Latino vote in various parts of the country and winning the Latino youth vote overwhelmingly. A lot of that success was the result of our campaign bringing on some extremely smart and hardworking Latinos like Arturo Carmona, Erica Andiola, and Cesar Vargas, who not only educated me about the issues of concern to their community, but also did a great job in voter outreach. On June 19th, while campaigning in Nevada, a state with a very heavy Latino population, I gave my first speech on immigration reform. I focused on the need for comprehensive immigration reform and a path towards citizenship. I also highlighted the fact that the vast majority of Latinos in this country are working class, and that for their sake, as well as for all working Americans, we had to raise the minimum wage to a living wage and make it easier for workers to join unions. In late June, a new Fox National poll was released. Clinton, 61%, Sanders, 15%, O'Malley, 1%. We were making progress. We were now only 46 points down. In Iowa, we were making more progress. In early July, a Quinnipiac poll came out that had Clinton ahead of us by 52% to 33% in Iowa. That's a big gap, but a lot better than the 60% to 15% we were behind in May. June 30th, the end of the quarter, was the day that candidates had to file information about the contributions they received over the previous 3 months. I used that occasion to issue a statement attacking the disastrous Citizens United Supreme Court decision. I announced that I would only nominate justices to the Supreme Court who publicly acknowledged their intention to overturn that terrible decision. I was glad to see Hillary Clinton make a similar statement a short time later. I also stated, "It is a national disgrace that billionaires and other extremely wealthy people are able to heavily influence the political process by making huge contributions. The Koch brothers alone will spend more than the Democratic and Republican parties to influence the outcome of next year's elections. That's not democracy. That's oligarchy." During this period, under the radar, our grassroots efforts were growing rapidly. Two examples come to mind. On June 26th, as a result of the great work done by Larry Cohn, the former president of the Communications Workers of America, we announced more than 1,000 local union leaders and members were backing our campaign. Clinton had been successful in winning the support of a number of national union leaders. We were now gaining support among the rank and file. On the same day, due to an aggressive social media effort launched by our campaign, 208,000 people signed a petition calling on the Democratic National Committee to host more presidential debates. The DNC was beginning to get the hint that many Democrats were not exactly enamored with its leadership. In an email we sent out, I said, "The people of this country are tired of political gossip, personal attacks, and ugly 30-second TV ads. They want the candidates to engage in serious discussions about the very serious issues facing our country today." Once again, we called for a more robust series of debates starting in the summer. Unfortunately, but not surprisingly, as we later learned, the DNC and Chairwoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz were not terribly interested in what we had to say. They had another agenda. While our early attention was obviously going to be focused on Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina, it was important to reach out to other states and let people all across the country know that we needed their support as well. Over the years, I had visited Wisconsin a number of times. I enjoyed participating in the Fighting Bob Fest, an event that brings thousands of progressives from Wisconsin together for a day of music, education, and agitation. This visit to Wisconsin on July 1st was very different from any I had previously made. I spoke at the Veterans Memorial Coliseum in Madison, and the Associated Press put the number of people in attendance at 10,000. This was not only the largest turnout for an event in our campaign, it was the largest turnout so far for any presidential candidate. In covering the event, CNN reported, Bernie Sanders has been running for president for 2 months, but Wednesday night in Madison, Wisconsin, his long-shot campaign got real. When Sanders walked on stage at the Veterans Memorial Coliseum, he was greeted by a raucous, howling crowd of 9,600 people, according to Sanders' campaign aides and the arena staff. A clearly energized Sanders, who late last year was speaking to crowds of 50 people in Iowa classrooms, appeared taken aback by the reception he received. "Whoa," he said. "In case you haven't noticed, there are a lot of people here." Sanders, who is rising in the primary polls and trails only Hillary Clinton, only mentioned the former Secretary of State once in his speech. This campaign is not about Bernie Sanders. It's not about Hillary Clinton. It is not about anyone else. It is about you, Sanders said to sustained applause. As the first half of 2015 ended and we entered the July 4th weekend, our leadership team, Jeff, Phil, Jane, Michael, Tad, and I, assessed where we were, and there was a lot of good news. We were holding the largest rallies of any candidate, our social media was humming and communicating with millions of people on an almost daily basis. The money was coming in much better than we had expected, and while we were still very far behind, we were making some progress in closing the gap in national and statewide polls. The bad news was that while we were doing well in local media markets, we were being more or less shut out of national television news, which is where Americans still get most of their information. It's hard to win an election if you're not on ABC, CBS, NBC, and PBS, and we weren't getting on those network evening news shows very much. In fact, between January 1st, 2015, and the end of November 2015, we had received only 10 minutes combined on the three major networks. That included all of 20 seconds on ABC. We were getting far less national network news time than other presidential candidates. Also, our efforts in the African American community were not going well. Nobody is going to win the Democratic nomination without a significant number of black votes. We were beginning to put reasonable sums of money and staff into our African-American outreach efforts, but Bill and Hillary Clinton were popular and universally known in that community, especially among older people, and it didn't appear that we were making much headway. Further, we were continuing to get almost no support from establishment politicians, and I mean none. Not one Democratic governor, not one big city mayor, and no more than a handful of members of Congress were supporting my campaign. In state after state, we would have to take on the entire Democratic Party machine and their get-out-the-vote apparatus, and that's not easy. While we obviously were going to focus on the early states, I was determined to take our message to every part of the country, from Maine to California, and that's literally what we did in the summer of 2015. We started in Iowa on the July 4th weekend. I love July 4th parades and had the opportunity to march in a few of them in Iowa. We also held a rally in Council Bluffs, which turned into our largest event yet in Iowa, with 2,600 people showing up. After Iowa, we got on a plane and headed to Portland, Maine, where we had another great event. It seemed like the entire city came out, but it was just 7,500, one of the largest political rallies that Portland had seen in a very long time. After the rally, we had dinner in a crowded local restaurant. The support there was joyous and seemed virtually unanimous. To top it off, the chef was from Burlington, We took a lot of selfies. From the day that I announced my candidacy, I was determined to run a positive campaign, not one involved in making personal attacks against Hillary Clinton or anyone else. In that regard, however, I went a little too far. For the sake of running a positive campaign, I had not been strong enough about articulating the many differences that I had with Clinton on some of the most important issues facing the country. I was determined to change that, and an opportunity arose on July 14, 2015, to make that happen. On that day, while the Senate was in session and I was in Washington, Secretary Clinton paid a visit to Congress to talk with fellow Democrats. I thought that her visit, which of course attracted widespread media coverage, would be a good time for me to contrast my differences with her. Nothing fancy, just a straightforward presentation of where we disagreed. In reporting what I did, David Espo of the AP wrote, "Former Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton was escorted by fellow Democrats, her way smoothed by uniformed officers, and her every pre-planned step tracked by a pack of chroniclers as she made the rounds of private meetings in the Capitol. It was more than enough for Bernie Sanders, the independent senator from Vermont who was Clinton's closest Democratic presidential rival in the polls. Emerging from one such meeting on Tuesday, Sanders strode fast-paced and trailed by a couple of aides to a collection of nearby television cameras. Let me welcome Secretary Clinton back to the Senate," he said, although in fact the greeting could more fairly be described as brisk and bracing rather than warm. His rival was behind closed doors with Democratic senators elsewhere in the Capitol when Sanders said that trade deals negotiated over the past two decades have been disastrous. "Secretary Clinton, I believe, has a different view on that issue," he said, although he omitted that as president, her husband had negotiated the North American Free Trade Agreement. "I strongly oppose the war in Iraq," he added. He didn't mention that Clinton supported it, but said, "Sadly, tragically, much of what I predicted, in fact, took place." Moving on to energy, Sanders said he has helped lead the opposition to the Keystone Pipeline. He added dryly, "I think Secretary Clinton has not been clear on her views on that issue," referring to her unwillingness to state a position on the proposal despite repeated requests that she do so. While not exactly unplanned, Sanders's appearance at the microphones was a reminder of the type of opportunistic campaign he is running as an underdog. The cameras were there in anticipation of comments by other lawmakers, but he made use of them. As a result, he got his say, and on a day that Clinton's aides had designed to highlight her role as a front-runner, conferring privately with Democrats who may well share the 2016 ballot with her. On July 18th, we headed to the Southwest, to Phoenix, Arizona, for what turned out to be, up to then, the largest rally of the entire campaign. More than 11,000 people showed up at the Phoenix Convention Center, including my daughter Heather and her husband Mark, who live in Sedona. What made me feel very good about that event was not just the size of the crowd, but the growing diversity that we were seeing. It had taken time, but we are now seeing more and more Latinos and blacks at our events. This was especially true in Phoenix. Throughout the campaign, my advance team did a very good job in arranging small meetings with local people before our rallies. This gave me an opportunity to meet privately with supporters and to hear the concerns of the people who lived in the area. It was an excellent way to learn about local issues and concerns. Before the Phoenix rally, I met briefly with five or six young Latinos. Some were teenagers, some a little bit older. All were born and raised in the United States. With tears in their eyes, they described to me their fears that, at a moment's notice, someone in their family, their mom or dad, could be deported. For them, immigration reform was very personal. It was an emotional meeting. I have not forgotten it. And then we were on to Texas, with large rallies in Dallas and Houston and a speaking appearance before the Texas Democratic Party. At both rallies, I spoke at length about the need for criminal justice reform and for ending the absurdity of the United States having more people in jail than any other country on earth. These rallies took place shortly after the horrific death of Sandra Bland, a young black woman who was found dead in her jail cell 60 miles outside of Houston. The quote-unquote crime that got her into that cell? She was pulled over for failure to use her blinker when she was making a turn. A shouting match developed with a very rude and aggressive police officer. She was thrown to the ground, handcuffed, and arrested. She died several days later in jail, all because of a minor traffic violation. But it was not just Sandra Bland. As the Black Lives Matter movement was pointing out, there were too many other victims, people like Michael Brown, Rakia Boyd, Eric Garner, Walter Scott, Freddie Gray, Tamir Rice, and many others. Many Americans, and not just African Americans and Latinos, are becoming increasingly outraged by police brutality. They are rightfully tired of turning on the television and seeing videos of unarmed blacks being shot and killed by police officers. They want criminal justice reform. They want police department reform, and I agree. In my remarks, I pointed out that as a former mayor and a senator, I had worked with police officers in my city and across the country, and that a police officer's job was enormously difficult. I also expressed the view that the vast majority of police officers are honest and hardworking. But I also made clear that when a police officer breaks the law, that officer must be held accountable. Further, police officers must be trained to understand that lethal force is the last response, not, as is too often the case, the first response. I also promised that, if elected president, I would make sure that all killings that took place when people were in police custody or being arrested would prompt a U.S. Department of Justice investigation. It was becoming very clear that the people we were bringing into our movement were not people who had been typically involved in Democratic Party politics or politics of any kind. These were newly engaged people, most often younger people, who were tired of status quo politics and wanted real change in the world in which they were living. In Houston, where 8,000 people attended our rally, I had an interesting discussion with a local Democratic Party leader. He told me, as he looked at the crowd, that he had never seen 95% of these people before. I have been for many years deeply concerned about climate change and the environment, and I'm proud to have one of the strongest pro-environment voting records in the U.S. Congress. I was very pleased that Bill McKibben, the founder of 350.org and one of the leading anti-global warming advocates in the world, was one of the speakers at my campaign's kickoff event. I was also proud that along with Senator Barbara Boxer, I had introduced the strongest climate change legislation in the history of the Senate. It was a real disappointment to me, therefore, that despite the fact that my environmental record was far stronger than Secretary Clinton's, I was unable to win the support of most of the major environmental organizations. On August 1, 2015, a breakthrough occurred. We were endorsed by Friends of the Earth Action, one of the largest and most progressive environmental organizations in the country, with some 2 million members worldwide. Eric Pica, president of Friends of the Earth Action, stated, "Senator Sanders's bold ideas and real solutions to addressing climate change, inequality, and promoting a transformative economy that prioritizes public health and the environment over corporate profits have earned him an enthusiastic endorsement from Friends of the Earth Action." In my remarks accepting the endorsement at a park along the banks of the Merrimack River in Concord, New Hampshire, I indicated my strong support for a tax on carbon and for massive investments in energy efficiency and sustainable energy. I also challenged Clinton for refusing to take a stand on the Keystone Pipeline, which would transport some of the dirtiest fuel on the planet. You could be for it, you could be against it, but you had to take a stand on one of the most important environmental issues of our time. In late September, I was glad to learn that Clinton came out in opposition to the environmentally destructive Keystone Pipeline. The issue of how many Democratic debates would be held and when and where they would take place was something that was getting more and more attention. The Republicans had announced a robust debate schedule that allowed their candidates to be showcased before millions of Americans. but that was obviously not what the Democratic National Committee had in mind. On August 6th, the DNC announced a series of only 6 debates. It was clear that they wanted to give Hillary Clinton's opponents as little public exposure as possible. I protested, as did Martin O'Malley. In my statement, I said, "I look forward to working with the DNC to see if we can significantly expand the proposed debate schedule." Needless to say, that did not happen. On August 6th, the Republican Party held its first debate, and I crashed it. Well, not exactly, but through social media. My staff urged me to tweet my responses to what I was hearing, and it turned out to be a very successful exercise. I sat on a couch at our headquarters, watched TV, and commented on what I was seeing and hearing. As the debate ended, I wrote, quote, "It's over. Not one word about income inequality, climate change, Citizens United, or student debt. That's why the R's are so out of touch," end quote. That got over 31,000 retweets and over 35,000 likes, by far the number one tweet of the night. If this was going to be a truly national campaign, we had to head out west, which is what we did in early August with a swing through Washington, Oregon, and California. That trip was one of the most exciting and memorable parts of the entire campaign. When we advertised our rallies through social media, we requested that people RSVP so that we could get some understanding of how many people might be showing up. As we hit the West Coast, the situation became absolutely nuts because of the incredible number of RSVPs we were receiving. Time and time again, we had to change our venue in order to accommodate the anticipated crowd. My staff had to work overtime in order to find arenas that could simply hold the crowds that we thought were coming. In Seattle, our first West Coast stop, we did our event at the Heck Edmondson Pavilion at the University of Washington, which holds 12,000 people. The lines to get in were never-ending, and the arena filled up quickly. Before I went in the arena to speak, I spoke to a crowd of 3,000 outside who were unable to get in. The 15,000 people who showed up for a rally in Seattle was our all-time record high for the campaign. But that record didn't last long. It was topped the very next night. In Seattle, I made the point about how important grassroots activism was in bringing about real change. As a result of a strong grassroots progressive movement in Seattle, the city council there raised the minimum wage to $15 an hour, the first major city in the country to go that high. I praised the city council and talked about legislation I had introduced to make $15 an hour the national minimum wage by 2020. I said, "You did it for Seattle. We're now going to do it for the entire country." On August 9th, we were in Portland, Oregon, at the Moda Center, where the Portland Trailblazers of the NBA play, a beautiful 3-tier arena. We filled it up, and then some. That event drew 28,000 people. The Oregonian did a good job describing the event. This is what they wrote. "Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' insurgent campaign for president received a big boost Sunday when as many as 28,000 showed up for a high-decibel rally at the Moda Center. The crowd packed the basketball arena with a capacity of up to 19,000, and thousands more couldn't get inside and listened in on loudspeakers. A Moda Center official, Michael Llewellyn, estimated the crowd at the free event totaled 28,000. The article continued, "I've never heard anybody say anything like that before," said Michaela Koenig-Taylor, a 25-year-old Bellingham, Washington resident. "I'm not personally involved with politics, but he changed my mind because he addressed the issues I actually cared about." In one sentence, Ms. Taylor described exactly what our campaign was all about, addressing the real issues that ordinary Americans cared about. The next night, we were at the Los Angeles Memorial Sports Arena, where 27,500 people attended. The clutch we did before the rally included some of the very creative members of the Los Angeles arts community, writers, actors, directors, musicians. We tapped their brains as to how, in whatever way, conventional or not, we could expand the campaign's horizon. There are a lot of smart and creative people in Los Angeles, not the least of whom is the brilliant comedian Sarah Silverman. Sarah, who was to be very helpful throughout the campaign, introduced me by saying, "I give you, if we're all very smart and a little bit lucky, the next president of the United States." In 3 days, we drew more than 70,000 people to our rallies. And here is an important point, which I believe differentiated our campaign from the others. At our rallies, I did exactly what the consultants tell you not to do. In each of the speeches, before tens of thousands of people, I spoke for at least an hour and discussed in some detail what I believe to be the major crises facing our country. I didn't begin with prepared jokes or some other routine, and I didn't shape my remarks around a soundbite for TV. I just laid it out as best I could. And here is what was remarkable. At all of these rallies, where we were filling up large arenas, people were not walking out during a long speech. They were not, I think, getting bored. They were listening. If there is a lesson I learned from this experience, it was that Americans are hungry for an understanding of what is going on in our country and how we can improve it. Needless to say, during the course of a long campaign, one receives many compliments. The compliment I remember most came from a young man at one of these rallies after I had completed my speech. He said, "Thank you, Bernie. You treat us as if we were intelligent human beings." It is an unbelievable and humbling experience to walk out on a stage and see 25,000 or 30,000 people filling up an arena to hear you speak. The moment not only fills you with awe, but with incredible optimism for the future. There was a microcosm of America in front of me. Black and white, Latino, Asian American, Native American, men and women, gay and straight, young and old. People who were tired of status quo politics and status quo economics. People who dreamed of a better America. People who wanted real change. To say that those experiences moved me would be a major understatement. They were some of the most memorable moments of my life, and I am deeply grateful to all who came. While we were in California, we picked up our first endorsement from a major national union, the National Nurses United, and its 185,000 members. What I love about the Nurses Union is not just that they are one of the most progressive unions in the country. It's not just that as a union that is 90% women, they showed enormous courage in supporting me over Hillary Clinton. It is that they are involved in politics because, as nurses, they know they cannot do the job they are trained to do, keeping people healthy, unless we transform this country. That is why they are strong supporters of a Medicare for All national health care program and other efforts that help low-income and working families. Time and again, I have heard from nurses as to how they cannot, as health care workers, do what has to be done for their patients when so many of them have no health insurance or are underinsured. The nurses also know what poverty and pollution do to human health. In explaining to The Guardian why they endorse me, Roseanne DeMauro, the union president, hit the nail on the head when she stated, "Nurses are an interesting group. They are not political scientists. They want to be nurses. But nurses see the fallout of all the bad decisions, because everything ultimately equates to health. If you are talking about income inequality, they see it. Health concerns and disparity among classes, joblessness, every social problem basically ends up presenting itself in a healthcare setting." Roseanne and the National Nurses Union played a great role in our campaign, and I thank them for that and for what they do every day to keep us healthy. During the summer, I received a most interesting invitation. I am one of the most progressive members of the U.S. Senate. Liberty University, a fundamentalist Christian school, is one of the most conservative schools of higher education in America. It was founded by Jerry Falwell, the leader of the Christian Coalition, and before his death, one of the leaders of the American conservative movement. The president is now his son, Dr. Jerry Falwell, Jr. It was not unusual for politicians and elected officials to speak at Liberty University. Over the years, many had. In fact, my Senate colleague, Ted Cruz, had virtually kicked off his campaign for the Republican presidential nomination at a speech to the student body there. Many public officials had spoken there, but none with my politics. Virtually all of the previous speakers had been conservatives, most very conservative. My instinct was to accept the invitation. The idea of going there appealed to me for several reasons. First, I always enjoy speaking to young people. Second, the thought of speaking to a group of people who looked at the world very, very differently than I did was intriguing and challenging. Was it possible to find some areas of common ground? Wouldn't it be useful to give these students a perspective that many of them may never have heard? Jane agreed with me, but not everyone in the campaign was on board. There were some who felt that going there could cause a rift with our supporters in the women's community and the LGBT community. Why, some supporters might ask, would we visit a university that had such a horrendous attitude on women's rights and gay rights, among many other views that I and our supporters rejected? After the officials at Liberty University assured my campaign that I would be treated fairly and respectfully, and that there was no intention to embarrass me or set me up, we agreed to accept the invitation. It would, I was sure, be an interesting day. Now all I had to do was write the speech, which was not an easy task, and not completed until the wee hours of the morning before I gave it. Here are excerpts of the speech that I gave before 12,000 students at Liberty University on September 14, 2015.
President Falwell and David, thank you very much for inviting my wife Jane and me to be with you this morning. We appreciate the invitation very much. And let me start off by acknowledging what I think all of you already know, and that is the views that many here at Liberty University have and I on a number of important issues are very, very different. I believe in women's rights. And the right of a woman to control her own body. I believe in gay rights and gay marriage. Those are my views, and it is no secret. But I came here today because I believe from the bottom of my heart that it is vitally important for those of us who hold different views to be able to engage in a civil discourse. Too often in our country, and I think both sides bear responsibility for us, there is too much shouting at each other. There is too much making fun of each other. Now, in my view, and I say this as somebody whose voice is hoarse because I have given dozens of speeches in the last few months, it is easy to go out and talk to people who agree with you. I was in Greensboro, North Carolina, just last night. All right. We had 9,000 people out. Mostly they agreed with me, and tonight we're going to be in Manassas and have thousands out, and they agree with me. That's not hard to do, and that's what politicians by and large do. We go out and we talk to people who agree with us. But it is harder, but not less important, for us to try and communicate with those who do not agree with us on every issue. And it is important to see where, if possible, and I do believe it's possible, we can find common ground. Now, Liberty University is a religious school, obviously. And all of you are proud of that. You are a school which, as all of us in our own way, tries to understand the meaning of morality. What does it mean to live a moral life? And you try to understand in this very complicated modern world that we live in what the words of the Bible mean in today's society. You are a school which tries to teach its students how to behave with decency and with honesty and how you can best relate to your fellow human beings, and I applaud you for trying to achieve those goals. Let me take a moment, or a few moments, to tell you what motivates me in the work that I do as a public servant, as a senator from the state of Vermont. And let me tell you that it goes without saying I am far, far from being a perfect human being, but I am motivated by a vision which exists in all of the great religions, in Christianity, in Judaism, in Islam, in Buddhism, and other religions. And that vision is so beautifully and clearly stated in Matthew 7:12. And it states, "So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. For this sums up the law and the prophets." That is the golden rule. Do unto others what you would have them do to you. That is the golden rule, and it is not very complicated. Let me be frank, as I said a moment ago. I understand that the issues of abortion and gay marriage are issues that you feel very strongly about. We disagree on those issues. I get that. But let me respectfully suggest that there are other issues out there that are of enormous consequence to our country and, in fact, to the entire world, that maybe, just maybe, we do not disagree on. And maybe, just maybe, we can try to work together to resolve them. Amos 5:24. "But let justice roll on like a river, righteousness like a never-failing stream." Justice, treating others the way we want to be treated, treating all people, no matter their race, their color, their stature in life, with respect and with dignity. Now here is my point. Some of you may agree with me, and some of you may not. But in my view, it would be hard for anyone in this room today to make the case that the United States of America, our great country, a country which all of us love, it would be hard to make the case that we are a just society or anything resembling a just society today. In the United States of America today, there is massive injustice in terms of income and wealth inequality. Injustice is rampant. We live, and I hope all of you know this, in the wealthiest country in the history of the world. But most Americans don't know that, because almost all of that wealth and income is going to the top 1%. Now that's the truth. We are living at a time, and I want all of you, if you would, put this in the context of the Bible, not me, in the context of the Bible. We are living at a time where a handful of people have wealth beyond comprehension. And I'm talking about tens of billions of dollars, enough to support their families for thousands of years, with huge yachts and jet planes and tens of billions, more money than they would ever know what to do with. But at that very same moment, there are millions of people in our country, let alone the rest of the world, who are struggling to feed their families. They are struggling to put a roof over their heads, and some of them are sleeping out on the streets. They are struggling to find money in order to go to a doctor when they are sick. Now, when we talk about morality,